You know, I was just talking to you, not that you have a robot.
Well, I'm Jason Luisi, as Phil just said, and I run the Premier Safety Institute. And one of the initiatives that we just recently launched in May of last year was our Secure Energy Initiative, an acronym standing for Securing Proven Healthcare Energy Reduction for the Ecosystem. And many of our tools are electronic. We have a website, it's premier.com/sphere. And we have, up to 10 case studies now on energy reduction. There'll also be a case study on Rukungaithi here with part of the information that we're going to hear today. What our goals are is to help hospitals reduce their costs, their use, increase their energy efficiency, and increase their use of renewables. And we have a listing of all of our contracts on that website. It's a public website. There's no password needed. What contracts we have for design and energy efficient equipment and consulting, architecture. And so those are all available on our website with information on how to get the contract numbers. You can take it in the supply chain advisor catalog, premier.com/sphere. And one of the initiatives that we launched first as part of it is our reverse auction for energy. And we have completed two auctions, one of them in the Northeast at Covenant Health System. We were able to save them $1.6 million in their energy contract. The second was at Ingalls in Illinois. Both of those are derated for electricity, where there's huge opportunities for savings. And at Ingalls, we were able to save them $750,000 and able to get some renewable energy in the mix. Normally, renewable energy is more expensive than traditional energy, but because of this reverse auction process, the energy suppliers are competing for business, of course, during the auction, competing for the hospital's business. And what happens is they're able to, in the process of wanting to get the business, really cut their margins so incredibly that they're offering in some of the deals renewable energy at the same price as standard energy from fossil fuels. So if any of you have contracts that are ending in the next year, any of your energy contracts, and you're looking to save your hospital some money, and you're in a state that's deregulated for electricity, or purchasing gas, most states are deregulated for gas, some of them are a little more expensive than others, we would love to have a chance to talk to you and tell you what we can do to help you save your hospital's money. So you just get in touch with me. We have lots of information on our website about our program. And you can download the form and fill in a little bit of information about your use and your where you buy your energy from. And then we can do a market assessment to see if, how much opportunity there would be for you in whatever area your healthcare facility is located. So if you have any interest in that, after the program, we can talk and I can get your information and get back to you. So let me formally introduce Al Lunar, who was kind enough to come here from far away to talk about financing infrastructure renewal with energy savings. And he has some wonderful information to share through his journal of many years at Geisinger. He's the Vice President of Facilities Operations, and he joined Geisinger in 1988. He's responsible for 200 employees serving a physical plant of 4 million square feet. We're located in Danville. And they have realized significant energy savings because he and his staff have been very creative in designing a strategy to manage their resources, which resulted in reduction of energy utilization while their physical plant expanded by more than 50%. And he's going to tell you about that. Geisinger is a known leader in healthcare across the board in quality, safety, as well as in energy reduction. And they've been an absolutely innovator in green building technology. They recently opened the Center for Health Research in Danville, which has a LEED Silver rating. Al specifically has won many awards for his achievements. One of them, the prestigious 2002 Hall of Fame Award of Excellence from the Association of Facility Engineers, for the work that he's done on Legionella remediation. So he comes very qualified to share with us some of his experiences at Geisinger. So I'm going to turn the rest of the time over to Al. And I didn't talk that much.
Okay. You did good.
Okay.
Would you like to introduce yourself? Tell us what you do.
Tom Romeo from Brookshire.
Okay. your function there?
I'm a pastor.
Okay.
Yeah, we're not just talking about town, we...
Yeah, while you were gone, we went around the room. Just open field for people's... But I really like having a room of CFOs, that's where we need to make our hay, so we're gonna talk a little bit about how you can do that. But I think you need to understand how timely this may be for you. The program we're gonna talk about here really grew out of the downturn in the early 90s, okay? When the economy, you know, we were facing layoffs, in fact had layoffs. None of us like to do that, me particularly. So what I was able to do is propose that we cut our budget by reducing energy usage. All right, that was far more lucrative than laying off staff, which we really didn't have enough of anyway. All right, so this is where this program grew from, and how much more timely can it be based on what we just heard at lunch, okay, and what we heard over at governance earlier this week. So basically, what we're talking about here is putting together a long-range plan, a program for your facilities infrastructure that becomes sustainably funded from savings, okay, so that you can do the things you need to do to not only make your plant better, more reliable, and less cost, all right, and our journey and how we got there. How many people here have enough money given to them by the organization to do everything they need to do in facilities? All right. You know, just to summarize, I mean, we're actually up at closer to 5 million square feet at the moment. You know, but we are at a point where off to, you know, at least in our organization, IT gets a chunk off the top of the corporate capital pot, which this year for us was 230 million thereabouts. And then the second piece off the top of the pot is facilities. You know, throughout the organization, I've got 3 hospitals, drug and alcohol treatment, and about 60 clinic sites, as well as other associated business sites. So, you know, that $5 million, first of all, is pretty incredible, because whenever I go to ASH or anywhere else, I'm constantly hearing facilities guys say, well, I'd really like to do this, but I can't get any money. You know, you're competing against the MRIs, the CAT scanners, you know, the new OR equipment and all that stuff. So what we're going to talk about is an approach how to get the money, you know, because quite frankly, this all stemmed from, you know, us trying to reduce energy, but also attending a presentation at ASHE some years ago where a guy from a hospital in Ohio, and I'm in Cincinnati, I'm not going to mention any names, did this great presentation on facility infrastructure planning for a multi-hospital system. And I mean, they had it down to, you know, chillers that need to be changed out, air handlers, cost savings, all this stuff, and closed out the session by saying, well, we didn't do any of it because we couldn't get the money. And I'm sitting here thinking, you asshole. You know, your job is to get the money, you know. How can you get up in front of all these people and say, here, look at this great thing I did, but didn't go anywhere because couldn't get the money. So, I mean, it really comes down to getting the money. All right, so with that said as an opening, let's get into a little bit about that. This is just a little bit about our health system. I mean, it's right now we've got a 10-story addition going on to the right of the campus there. Center for Health Research is not on there yet. We also just last week got a Leeds Gold Award for our Leeds Gold for a clinic building that we built in State College, which is probably going to grow to a hospital. And another one we anticipate in Wilkes-Barre that will be getting Leeds Gold within the next month. Again, this is set the background. When this all started taking place in the early 90s, we had 1.2 million square feet on the main campus. We've expanded roughly 60% by then. Actually, that number is closer to 80 or 90% now. We've realized utility savings of $3 million and gotten some recognition along with that. Now, this is nothing new to you guys, all right? Everything's got a life. You know, I don't care whether it's an air handler that's got a 25, 30-year life before it starts rattling apart. You know, roofs have a life. Everything in a building has a timeframe in which it should be replaced. So if we all want to look at this on a financial basis, we need to take that into account, all right, what its expected life is, and plan how we want to do that, all right, not just, you know, too many times in facilities people are reacting to fires. Oh, I need a new roof over on the pavilion, you know, I started getting leaks, and well, that really shouldn't happen, all right. You know, we should have that in a plan structure that, okay, I anticipate sometime in the next 7 year, you know, between years 4 and 7, I'm going to have to get out that roof because it's out of warranty at this point. It's been on for, you know, 15 years. So I need to plan for that money. All right. So we're going to take this whole facilities management thing from reactionary to a plan basis, because that's what the CFO is going to listen to. All right. You're not making his day when you come rattling at this door for $500,000 because something happened, that he's got to suddenly shit this money that he didn't plan for. All right, so your chances are much better if you can have this all laid out for him ahead of time. All right, so everybody agrees with that, right? Here's another thing we ran into. Both of you guys, facility guys, said you were involved in construction. And one of the battles we always fight is getting the right stuff in the building, all right? You know, nobody wants to hear when the project budget is reasonably tight that, you know, we could put a more efficient chiller in that building for an extra $100K, all right? And we let those upfront costs drive our decision-making process when it really shouldn't. Now, what this chart is showing you is that if you look at the 40-year life cycle cost of a building, all right, all the costs that are attributed to that building over 40 years, you'll see that the construction piece there in beige is actually 11% of that cost, all right? Yet the lion's share is an operating expense of that building, which accounts for 50% of the cost. So making that decision for $100,000 on a more efficient chiller up front and not getting it is the tail wagging the dog. All right, because that upfront capital cost is minute compared to the operating cost. You know, in fact, in this case, it's a 5-to-1 ratio. All right, so chances are, I mean, looking at the chiller efficiencies or whatever that thing might be that would make that building operate more efficiently, I can take that, you know, 100 grand, multiply it by 5, and that's really worth $500,000 to me over the life cycle of that building, probably. All right. You know, in those cases, we need to do the math when we're evaluating other things, but it's a huge impact when we look at the cost, because, you know, not too many of us are walking away from buildings after 10 years. All right, so why do we, in fact, many cases, you know, as you're presenting stuff to the CFO, you know, they say, well, I want to look at a 3-year payback. Well, why? We're only going to be here 3 years? You know, that's not common in healthcare in our buildings, so. So realize that, you know, up front in these capital projects, we need to get what we need. So what are we going to call, you know, what is infrastructure? What am I talking about here? You know, what we're talking about is all the utility systems, the roofing, the window. In general, it's the building, all right, all the physical assets. One of the curious things about this, who ends up getting most of the capital in your different organizations?
Radiology.
Okay. One of the reasons you'll be told is that, well, they've got the most assets, right? Yeah, you know, they're high-dollar stuff. Radiology, when you look at it, I mean, actually, if you look at all the assets of the organization, you know, your book value, you know, that's a number you should become familiar with from your finance people. The buildings account for about 75% of that, but yet we don't get 75% of the capital, okay? So it's the glamour of some of these things that's what's getting them the capital, and part of it's market competitiveness. But, you know, as you being charged with operating facilities, know that you have the biggest chunk of assets that your organization holds, and that's the value of your buildings, all right, and the systems within them. These are just numbers we use. You can assign your own. I mean, our anticipation is that in building components, we'll get 20 years roof life out of roofs. You know, we look at finishes, flooring, paint schemes, other things, 10 years. Obviously, in some areas, that's not going to hold true. But across the board, when you look at clinics and everything else, that's what we strive for. Windows, mechanical systems. Okay. So what I'm here to talk to you about a little bit, and then we're going to get into how we get there, is to develop what we call a five-year plan, all right? I don't think any of us in healthcare has a horizon that can go beyond 5 years. I mean, it's just too dynamic. When talking to the CFO and to the folks you need to talk to get money, I mean, I always like to use examples like your house. You know, there's not a year goes by where they don't have to do the spouting or the dryer crapped out on you, have to change it out, or, you know, new carpeting in a room or whatever, because that's something they can relate to. They understand that. They, you know, they have houses too. So it's a good example to use. The other thing is that infrastructure replacement reduces your operating expenses. Generally, when you change something out, you know, whether it be a chiller, whether it be an air handler, whether it be almost anything you do, there's an associated operating expense savings. All right. Number one, it's going to require less maintenance, but number two, it's generally going to use less energy. And in fact, that's one of the things I'm going to endorse you to strive for whenever you change something else, like buying a new PC. You don't want to buy last year's model PC because it's just going to be outdated that much quicker. So go for the most efficient equipment you can buy, because on the same principle, it's going to serve you much longer. You're going to reap more savings from it. The other thing that happens once you put together this kind of plan is Joint Commission loves this. You know, because you're not only talking about preventive maintenance, you're talking about asset replacement. Yeah, you know, we had a generator years ago that died, and it was 50 years old. Okay. I was pretty amazed it lasted that long. The insurance company gave us a hard time. Well, you weren't doing right preventive maintenance on it. Come on, thing's 50 years old. But when Joint Commission comes in, you say, okay, this is what I've got, this is how we take care of it. But on top of that, I don't have a chiller older than 12 years old, because we have a capital replacement plan that's funded annually by the corporation, and this is how we handle that, all right? So this is, as part of your utility management plan, it's just like icing on the cake, all right, to be able to sit and show how you've reinvested in your facilities and not only try to maintain old equipment, but indeed got out and replaced it. So we're just going to take a quick breathe through this. I didn't update this from when this was put together. But what we did is we took a look at all sites, all different components of building. All right. So in this case, this is the building itself. And so we've got roofing, windows, waterproofing, code compliance issues, you know, things that we might have corrections on for either sprinklers or fireproofing or whatever, doors and hardware. Break down, look at electrical systems, what our needs are. You know, in this case, you know, we had an issue with some transfer switches we wanted to address that we knew about. Normal power to the LL, we didn't have a like split between normal and emergency. That was all emergency at that site. But anyway, breaking down all the things that you know that you need to do or would like to do over the next 5 years, all right? And include in that things that will conserve energy. Again, same thing for air conditioning systems. And you see what we're doing here. You know, one of the things when you do, when you put this together, when you get all these things inventoried that you need to do, is you then want to balance the cash flow. All right, so you may, you know, because you don't want to end up going to the CFO and saying, well, I need $2 million next year and $10 million this year and $3 million, you know. So you want to come together with a plan that says, look, if you give me $2 million across the next 5 years, this is all stuff I'm going to take care of, all right? Because that makes it easier for their planning to happen. You know, again, different items here, you know, upgrade power plant, though, is an efficiency issue. There's really nothing wrong with it, but you know, we'll talk about that as a specific project as we go. And these are just examples, you know. And every year we do, you know, finish replacement. So that's what's shown here. You know, the bottom line is once you get this sold, you don't ever want to have to go back to the CFO again. All right. So no matter what happens, you need to absorb it out of this pot. All right. Also, we get into site work. One thing we do not include in these is growth. Okay, so if we're building a new building and there's a need for more parking on campus, that's not coming from here. That's fair game to go back to them and say, look, you know, you got more traffic coming, you've grown clinical volumes. This is new. This isn't infrastructure replacement. This is new. All right, so those figures aren't included in this. So, you know, we've kind of outlined what our needs are. We're gonna balance that cash flow across 5 years, what we think we need to do our jobs properly and to make the organization and our buildings better. Now, if you go to the literature, there's some different ways you'll find that people justify investing in infrastructure. And so this was kind of our benchmark to see what are the recommended levels. I absolutely found nothing in healthcare. All right, there's not a recommended level for funding. There does seem to be some recommendations from education industry, you know, whether it's schools or universities. And that's where really these are from. And there's a lot of work in Canada on this. But, you know, one of the things that we've seen is that that you can take the asset, you know, your total asset value of all your buildings, and, you know, if we just make the assumption that everything's got a 50-year life, that would lead us to believe that we need 2% of that asset value every year. I mean, it's simple math, you know. So that's one way to do it. Another way is a cost per square foot that we found it, and in the literature, you'll see anywhere between $1 and $5 a square foot for facilities renewal, all right, to keep up with the buildings and their systems. Now, for us, at the time we did this was put together, that would have been $6 million. We've never gotten there. We actually live pretty comfortably at $1 a square foot, which is about where we are now. So our $5 million is, you know, we're roughly 5 million square feet. So the key to getting this and talking to the CFO is to sell the concept of perennial funding, which is what we've been talking about. And it needs to be treated as a pot of dollars. All right, now, you guys have probably heard the concept of a maintenance bank, maybe in your careers. What that means is that we're given the flexibility to spend this money as we see fit. I mean, our objective is to do the things that were on our inventory and on our schedule. But, you know, if a chiller dies, we need to cover that and push something else back till next year. Because once we have a financial plan that the CFO agrees to, the last thing we want to do is say, well, I need more. All right, we want to live within those means. And then operating this as a maintenance bank or a rollover fund really helps a lot. What we're able to do, like let's say, I'll give you some specifics on how we do that. But if I have $5 million this year and our fiscal year starts July 1, if I've only spent or committed $4.5 million, that half million that I didn't commit doesn't go away. It just rolls over into next year's funding. Okay. Some other things that make this easier to operate. As you all know, I don't know if you ever tried to buy a generator or a large transformer. Some of the lead times on this stuff's a year. Okay. I know last year I needed a 69,000 volt transformer. I ended up buying one off the web, you know, because the lead time was 56 weeks. And I didn't think I could wait. So anyway, what we do to cover that is that we get our allocations in two ways. On July 1, we'll receive the $5 million, okay? But then on January 1, we're allowed to pre-commit $2 million for the following July 1. In other words, if I need design on something, if I've got a long lead time item, you know, so in essence, let's say at July 1, by January 1, I've only spent $1 million of my five. Starting on January 1, I really have then $6 million to commit. You know, the four I didn't commit yet, plus the two for the following fiscal year. However, bottom line is we can't ever exceed our cash flow of $5 million because that's a deal signed in blood with the CFO. All right, so we need to manage that cash flow. All right, but you know we have sold them that because of long lead time items, because of the need to design some of these systems and things like that, that they need to give us that flexibility, all right, to spend this money appropriately. Here's a history of where we've been funded up through this year. I mean, some years it goes up and down, and that's really based on what the capital needs are of the system, but you know we've been pretty successful. And moving through this. Now, now you're, at this point, you've got a plan together, you've got funding levels established, now it's time to sit down and talk with the guy with the money, all right? And, you know, you need to talk in his terms, okay? You know, he doesn't care about kilowatt hours, BTUs, any of the things we talk in terms of, percent saving, you know, he just doesn't care. Kind of something just popped into my mind, that we were sitting with the position at lunch over here, and he made the statement, why bring in all the money? You know, why were you guys, because we're at governance, why were yous over at the Westin, and we're here? I'm the one who brings in all the money. And I've had that discussion with physicians, and one thing you need to keep in your mind, most healthcare systems operate at, what, maybe about a 3% return? Somewhere thereabouts. I mean, I think we're doing pretty good when we're at 3, 3.5. You need to turn those numbers around, okay? And I don't mean improve the 3%. 3%, all right, is if you divide that into 100, you have 33. So in other words, if you have a, let's say, an energy-saving project that saves you $100,000, all right, times 33, is $3.3 million worth of revenue. Okay? So that $100,000 is equivalent to $3.3 million worth of business to the health system. All right? I will guarantee you there is not a physician out there who brings in $3.3 million worth of business. You know, you'll find that most of them are running at $1.5 million, you know, somewhere in that range. So learn to use the numbers in your favor. And CFOs also tend to think of not so much in terms of savings or expense, but in terms of revenue. I mean, you're always hearing revenue when we're talking to the CFO. All right, know what the book value of a facility is. All right, know what your buildings are worth. I mean, there's a number finance is carrying on the books for what the value of your plan is, okay? You need to know that. What's your annual depreciation expense? All right. I mean, you all know what depreciation is, but do you realize that that's really the source of your capital? Okay. I mean, funded depreciation is just that. That's what really funds the capital expansion, because it's not a real expense. I mean, it comes off your BVA statement or your budget versus actual, but the money doesn't go anywhere, so that's part of what's reinvested in the facility. So know what the depreciation expenses of your buildings is, because that's what should be reinvested. Okay, so use that as a tool. I'm trying to give you a toolkit to go at this guy with. We talked about this a little bit already. The building value, your assets, your buildings far exceed anything else, radiology, surgery, etc., even though they generally get most of the capital. IT should be on this list. but, you know, your buildings are worth about 3/4 of the assets of the organization. Return on investment. All right, as you make these investments, I mean, everything you do, and I don't care, you know, if you change out a roof and it's, you know, a built-up roof and you're going to change it out, do something to give it an ROI. Change it to a white roof, improve your insulation level, but every dollar you spend, try to get something back for it, all right, in terms of energy. We just talked about this, the example of the 3% return. Turn your savings into equivalent revenues for the organization, all right? It's just a much bigger number. Hell, if you're operating at a 1% return, it's, you know, 100 times what the savings are. So all of a sudden, that $100,000 is equivalent of $10 million worth of revenue, all right? One of the things I taught at governance this week, and when I spoke over there, is that, and, you know, that's the CFOs and all those folks, is how investment in their facilities and energy savings technologies is really a better investment than it is in healthcare or in the market. I mean, we all see what the market did this year. You know, that's the reason we're all struggling, because we have no reserves anymore, or at least they've been cut significantly. Know what the cost of your capital is when you talk about these things. All right, whether you issue bonds, I mean, we're all nonprofits, so you probably get your capital through securing bonds. Know what that interest rate is, because we're gonna talk about other ways to finance things. And it's always best to do this out of your own capital, because that's generally the lowest form of interest you can get, so it's really gonna benefit your organization. also know what the financing options are. We're going to talk about this a little bit more, because, you know, one time when we were first early on into this, we were in tough financial times, and we actually went out and did some leasing for energy projects, okay, some operational leases. And we'll talk about how to evaluate those and what might work. And then what's this effect on facilities operations? I mean, if I have together a plan where I'm addressing finishes and improving reliability of equipment, I'm going to have less outages, I'm going to have a better-looking facility, better first impression, all the other things you can think of you want to have in your sales pitch, all right? I mean, better first impression means, you know, more return business, people feel better, you know, less impact operations from roof leaks, from air conditioners breaking down, all those things, what those positive impacts are. So, we've got a framework. What's the bottom line here? First of all, out of our list of projects, some of which were energy, we want to pick the low-hanging fruit. All right, that's what low risk is. I mean, has everybody here, for instance, done a lighting project? All right, that's low-hanging fruit, zero risk. I mean, if I've got 80 watts, I change it to 40, I save 40 watts. You know, there's no way not to save it. Always install most efficient systems available. We talked about that. All right, you know, if I can buy a chiller that's got half a kW per ton better, well, not half a kW per ton, but a 0.1 per kW per ton better than another model, that's probably the one I want to go after. All right. Every year, do some sort of energy project, because what we want to start doing is when we build a track record with the CFO, we want to show him that, okay, you gave me this money, here's what I've done with it, and here's what I can give back to you. All right. And then also invest in modernizing your oldest systems first. I mean, that, you know, that's just common sense. So how do we measure the savings of what we accomplished, what we're doing? We need to be able to show real dollar reductions. I say that because, actually the last point here, ignore maintenance savings. I don't ever throw that in there because my CFO will immediately say to me, how many guys you cutting? Okay, so just take it off the table. You know, don't even offer it up. You know, go strictly on energy, okay? I mean, you may be able to throw in some parts or something, you know, longer lamp life if you're going from T12s to T8s or whatever, but, you know, don't offer up maintenance savings because unless you're cutting somebody, it doesn't exist. And I'm sure you've got other stuff for that guy to do, all right? Talk in terms of dollars, always. You know, again, they don't care about BTUs, efficiency, kit over per ton, nothing. You know, they want to know dollars, period. We talked about financing, so, and we said we'd talk a little bit more about that. You know, do you do this out of cash, capital, or do you do it out of credit? The reason, you know, we did one on an operating lease, and the reason was I was seeing that because of the capital needs of the organization that I might be cut back in my infrastructure funding. We really didn't, it never happened. I didn't need to do this, but I wanted to open the door, all right, for another funding stream, which was an operating lease. You know, our organization does not allow capital leases, all right, but we're allowed to use operating leases if it passes a bunch of tests. So actually, that's how we did our lighting project, all right. And the way that was structured, you know, we spent $1.8 million. We had annual savings of $460,000. And structured the lease for a $300,000 annual payment, so we had a net income stream of $160,000 for the term of the lease. You know, after that, then we saved the whole amount. All right. So, in other words, it paid for itself. It's always better to do it out of capital because you don't have to. I mean, that wasn't easily done. That took me a year to get that through Treasury. Okay. But I just saw this future dark cloud out there that someday I may not be able to get the capital we need. So we did that to blaze the trail, if you will. Operating leases is preferred structure not rather than capital because capital leases you still have to account for depreciation. All right, so it's kind of a double hit accounting wise. If you're doing that structure to financing and provide, you know, significant positive cash flow, I mean, if you kind of make it balanced and you're saving 10 bucks a year, nobody's really going to care. You know, but if you have an extra 160,000 laying around, that's a number big enough to have somebody's attention. And then performance contracts, I'm sure you've all been approached by performance contracting companies, Johnson Train, your, you know, name them. I don't endorse them. Essentially, a performance contract is nothing more than an operating lease with a guarantee, all right? So for instance, you know, I was speaking at World Energy Congress a couple of years ago, like a guy from Canada says, well, I just did an operate, you know, a performance contract on lighting. And, you know, I'm kind of blunt. I said, well, that's pretty stupid, you know. There's no risk, you know. So why have, why, essentially when you're getting a performance contract, what you're buying is insurance, okay? If I can't not save it, what am I insuring? I mean, so, you know, what happens, that risk translates into a higher percentage rate of interest, okay? So on our lighting project, for instance, we might have had, you know, 4.5% interest rate, you know, through Citicorp, you know, based on, we're a AA bond rated healthcare system. And if I'd have done that on a performance contract, it probably would have been 8%. You know, so what are you buying for that 4%? It's all dollars, you know, think it's all dollars. So what are conclusions we can draw? That, you know, obviously we need facilities renewal investment strategy. All right, so we're going to do that by building a plan. Recommend a target of $2 a square foot. I mean, part of the reason we can survive on one is because of our size. So, you know, a smaller place, you don't have that inertia that you know, so you may need higher than a dollar that we have. And so it it doesn't hurt to shoot for two, because you can always compromise then at one and let the CFO think he won. And since these are generally asset replacement projects, we want a long-range plan that we just update annually. All right, so we work from a rolling five-year plan. These are just some examples of things that we did in the early years of this. You can see at this point we expended $8 million. We generated energy savings from that of $2.2 million, so not too bad. I mean, overall, four-year ROI, particularly when you're doing stuff like roofs and everything else lumped in there. All right, that's not just energy projects, that's everything. So now that we've done that, we want to look at how we're, you know, because the goal of this plan is not to only renew our assets, but to make this thing self-generate by having enough energy savings to pay for it. I mean, that's really where we're going here, all right? And that's what we've accomplished, all right? So to do that, we need to start looking at how our buildings use energy, all right? Whether you have some sub-metering, you know, there's literature out there for hospitals. You can find some stuff on the Energy Star website, although I don't believe their numbers that they have. You know, for instance, they had a number for energy used for hot water heating that was 25% of the total thermal energy in the hospital for domestic hot water. I don't believe that. You know, it's not anywhere near what my experience is. But anyway, we've broken down our electrical energy here, for an example, into HVAC, lighting, and others. And based on that, then we started attacking what projects electrically we would do. First of which was we built our own substation. You know, that realized a little bit over a two-year payback, and that's just a rate. There's no efficiency with that, but still it's a return on investment because we moved to a lower utility rate. All right. We went from a, you know, 12,000-volt services to 69,000-volt services, which at that time yielded $250,000 annually. That number now is probably slightly more than that. Electrical distribution, you'd think, yeah, okay, buy new switchgear, big deal. How's that save me money? All right. Well, as we did that and did our high voltage network, we found we had 40 amps going to ground. Okay, 40 amps at 12,000 volts. That's worth $50,000 a year. Okay. Wasn't something we anticipated going in. I didn't think I'd get a return off of this project other than reducing outages and things. However, you know, in the midst of that, we found this bad set of cables that we didn't know we had, and generated that kind of savings from that infrastructure renewal. Lighting, we've talked about, you know, there's a lease structure, annual savings. It's pretty significant when you reduce the demand of a campus by a megawatt, all right? But that's the impact that we saw. And that's one of the prime things, as we do a synopsis here, that we'll talk about, because what we've been able to do is grow our campus from 1.2 million square feet in Danville to 2.1 without increasing electrical demand. Okay, we were at 8 megawatts then, we're at 8 megawatts now. We had the same electric bill, but in that process, we added 80% more square footage. We've added 8,000 PCs, and we also converted all our air conditioning from absorber steam to electric. All right, so if you work that backwards and say that really equates to a 43% reduction in electricity we use per square foot. All right. A bigger look at is cooling. I mean, between air handlers and chillers, I mean, that accounts for, 30-40% of our electrical load, all right, systems that run a lot. And so in our case, we were running absorbers, and they were, worst of all, they were low-pressure absorbers, so you see that cost on the left was at 9 cents a ton. And we're now at all-electric chillers, which for us is about 3.5 cents a ton, all right. One of the projects we're just now completed, you'll see off-peak electric. We've actually now just moved on to installing a 8,000-ton-hour chilled water storage tank. It's 1.086 million gallon, so that we can make cooling at night. And that's got other benefits, too, we'll talk about. So here we go. I mean, we replaced our absorbers with chillers, saved about $360,000 annually, on that, moving from that 9 cents a ton to 3 cents a ton. The next thing to take back as a tool is understanding maybe a little bit more about air conditioning than you do. How many people here have chillers and cooling towers? Everybody? Great. Do you know why? Don't look at me like that. because this is one of the things you fight in a new building many times, all right? It's cheaper to put on, rooftop air conditioning units, for instance, than build a chiller plant. And the reason you use a chiller is because the refrigeration cycle is called lift. I mean, we're operating at 42 degrees chilled water normally, 42, 44, somewhere in there. And we run our cooling towers at what temperatures? Where do you run it? How low do you let them go?
65.
Good. I walk into a lot of places. I do consulting. I just did a university a couple of weeks ago. I walked in and they have chillers and their condensing temperature set at 85 degrees. That's what I always do. What are you doing that for? Well, train says we have to do that. Ah, that's good. The reason you do that is that the energy you put into the chiller is equivalent to the thermal lift, is proportional to the thermal lift. And the thermal lift is the difference between the chilled water temperature and the condensing water temperature. All right? So what these two walls signify here is if I have 42 to 85, all right, that's a 43 degree thermal lift. But if I lower that to 75, I now only have 31 degree thermal lift, all right? The beauty of that is for every degree I reduce the thermal lift, I save 2% of energy on a chiller. Okay, so if I reduce my condensing temperatures by adding cooling towers, sometimes just lowering a thermostat, whatever I reduce it, I save 2% for every degree, okay? So, the amount of energy is proportional to the differential temperature. So that's an easy thing to do. Now, I give this to you because we're going to talk now about cooling towers and some other things, all right? But it sounds like at least these are all using a low enough set point, 55, 60 degrees. And you're not always going to get that, but the thing is, get it when you can, all right? So what do we do, all right? So most of your cooling towers, I don't know how much you know about your cooling towers. I'm guessing they're probably 10 to 12 degree approach towers. Okay, that's standard design. We went beyond standard. We switched out all our cooling towers to 5-degree approach towers. So we picked up 5 degrees on every chilled water system. All right, that's 10% energy savings. And the beauty of that 2% per degree is you get it back the other way in capacity when you don't when you're fully loaded, all right? So if I put in better cooling, you know, bigger cooling towers, and now all of a sudden on a design day, on a 95-degree day, I'm not running 85-degree water anymore, I'm running 80, all right, pick up that 5 degrees, because cooling towers work on approach to wet bulb temperature, so, you know, they're very sensitive to ambient conditions. That saves me not only 10% when I don't need the capacity, but when I do need the capacity, it gains me 10% capacity. So if I got a 1,000-ton chiller, I lower that temperature 5 degrees by installing a bigger tower, I've now got an 1,100-ton chiller. Okay? And that's one of the reasons that your chiller manufacturers don't want you to do this, because they don't want you to, you know, they want you to buy another chiller. Okay? So we want to put it to them, too. You know, but anyway, by doing this, you know, we saved $40,000 by lowering our approaches. We also go with a system called, that we kind of developed, approach to wet bulb control. And this saves a lot of, there's two things save you fan horsepower on a cooling tower. One is don't use cross-flow towers. All right, a cross-flow, what kind of towers do you guys have? Cross-flow, counter-flow? Where are the louvers? On the sides? Cross-flow tower. Okay, cross-flow tower, air goes in and up, counterflow comes in from the bottom. Counterflow towers